Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. We have a wonderful treat for you today. Amy Benjamin, who is a lecturer in the School of Law at the Auckland University of Technology and has researched and published on false flags, state terror, secrecy, and the rule of law in lots of top academic journals, and a former attorney at Department of Justice, has joined us. She joined us last year. She published in October 2017 a marvelous paper, which I recommend to you strongly, called The Many Faces of Secrecy. In fact, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson had for months, he was a part of the peer review at William & Mary, kept saying, oh, there's this fabulous article and I can't tell you what it's called and I can't tell you who it's by, but you're just going to absolutely love it. And then finally it was published. And I was so impressed with Amy's analysis of secrecy and how it's engineered and written in a way that a person who's not an expert in these areas can really understand. I called her because I was headed down to Australia and then over to New Zealand and said, will you meet me in Auckland? And so in the spring of 2018, we met and did a Solari report called The Many Faces of Secrecy. It was so popular, it was chosen as one of the top four of the year that we republish at Christmas time. And so many people said, you know, I could never understand how all this stuff could be going on and me not know. And now I do. And part of it was Amy also focuses on the role of contractors and outsourcing, which, you know, you hear a lot from us. So with no further ado, Amy, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule, coming to us all the way from Auckland and joining us on the Solari Report.
Catherine, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. You're one of my biggest heroes, contemporary heroes.
Well, we're going to talk today about tax and spend, the deep state's next harvest. But yes. Before we do, I want to just cover a little bit. If you haven't heard my discussion with Amy and read her piece, I strongly recommend it. It's in the archives, The Many Faces of Secrecy. But a lot has happened in the secrecy world since we did that interview. And I wanted to – your paper came out a month after Dr. Skidmore's publication of his report on the $21 trillion of missing money. And yes. One of the things you focused on was the role of private contractors in engineering secrecy. And I thought maybe we could just touch a little bit on that before we dive into our topic tonight.
Sure. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to say how much private contracting is linked to or responsible for the $21 trillion. I have a sense that probably direct secrecy is more responsible for that. Oops, you know, we can't account for $21 trillion. But private contracting is when the government is able to go dark because the government hands off its functions to private entities that aren't subject to or not easily subject to the sunshine laws that allow the public to trace what happens in government, like the Freedom of Information Act and other sunshine laws that came out of the 1970s. And so when the government contracts out those functions, those tasks, it could be war fighting through private armies. It could be sort of national security functions like airport security that's often outsourced. It can be, you know, welfare programs that are outsourced to charitable organizations. It can be, you know, it runs the whole gamut. When these functions are handed off to corporations, even to nonprofits, the public can't see as much via these sunshine laws, as much about what's going on, the decisions are made, the reasons for the decisions, what was relied upon in making the decisions, how the money's spent. They can't see nearly as well as they used to be able to see when some functions were performed directly by government entities.
Right. Right. Do you want to explain a little bit about direct versus indirect secrecy?
Sure. Direct secrecy is when the government continues to perform a function, but keeps details of the function secret on the grounds usually of national security. And so it will use classification schemes of the national security state, you know, ranging from, I don't know what the highest classification is. It's probably not top secret. That's probably the middle classification. but, you know, top secret stamps and the like, or classified hearings in Congress, or You know, if you request something via FOIA, you might find that much of the document, well, the document will be given to you, but much of it will be redacted, and there will be a FOIA exemption ground invoked, usually national security. And that's direct secrecy. That's the government saying, we're doing something, it's secret, you can't know, but we've got good national security related reasons for you not to know. That's direct secrecy. Indirect secrecy is when they hand off, for example, outsourcing, which can be outsourced to corporations or in the case of, you know, controlling the money supply, you know, to the Federal Reserve System. They hand over functions to entities outside the government, and they don't invoke national security for that. They invoke other reasons like, oh, you know, the private sector or the banking sector can handle these worthwhile government functions more efficiently. We'll get cost savings, blah, blah, blah. We're doing it for these reasons. And then the secrecy is produced indirectly because, as I said, the Sunshine Laws don't tend to follow the handing off of the government functions. So right. That's what I labeled indirect secrecy. Secrecy is not invoked directly by the government. As a matter of fact, it's often denied. They don't want people to know they're giving away their functions in order for those functions to go dark. But they instead invoke these other values like cost savings and greater efficiency. And that's a bunch of baloney. Because
it's always
like the most lucrative thing you can do, be a government contractor. And no one connects those dots. No one says, hey, you know, wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute. If government contracting is so lucrative, how can this be, you know, saving the taxpayers money? It's just a bunch of bull.
Well, it's incredible because I've never seen an outsourcing or privatization that was more, you know, sort of efficient than government doing it. It's invariably much more expensive. Yeah.
I mean, it might be efficient in a real kind of microeconomic sense that when they perform the task, they're devoting the least amount of resources for the best product at the lowest cost, but that doesn't mean they're charging the government the lowest cost. That means they're making a big profit. So they might be doing it really efficiently, but that doesn't mean it's costing the taxpayers less money.
Right. It's one of the reasons I wrote the Dylan Reed case study, to show you, you know, how government was literally being bankrupt by all these schemes that were making the private sector a fortune while they were, you know, saying that they were more efficient. And this was all very productive, but it absolutely wasn't. We used to always laugh because we'd see these neighborhoods where HUD was paying, you know, $1,200 a month rent on its voucher program for an apartment, whereas the market rate apartments across the street in a nicer building would be going for $800. No, it went on and on and on. I have thousands of examples.
It's so obvious, Catherine, to any layperson. You don't have to be an academic. As a matter of fact, the stupid academic economists are still writing journal articles saying, you know, outsourcing is a good thing for the taxpayer. They're just idiots, except for a few legal academics who I'm thinking in particular of a man named Paul Fercule and a colleague of his who for years touted the benefits of outsourcing, the public benefits.
Well, but Amy, if I can steal $21 trillion, I can buy a lot of academics.
Oh, gosh. But this particular fellow, Paul Fercule, sort of realized a couple of years ago, in the last 10 or so, that actually outsourcing's ostensible benefits were ostensible only and not really real. And he and his fellow academic wrote an astonishing article saying, we need to insource. In order to save the taxpayers, we need to start bringing back the functions into government. We need to start increasing the federal workforce in order to save taxpayer money. And it was just an astonishing article. I don't think it's gained a lot of traction. It's a little too little too late. I mean, the academics were on the bandwagon, and the academics have been bought off, not directly, but certainly indirectly. They're you know, looking for grant money, and they're looking for, you know, nice invitations to nice conferences funded by all those lovely, you know, corporatists sort of standing quietly at the back of the room sort of thing. So, you know, it's difficult. The academics will have to be dragged kicking and screaming for the most part into the real world.
There's no doubt if you wanted to stop money from going missing in the federal government, you would have to insource the information systems and probably even the bank accounts, because the more you've outsourced, the more money's gone missing. I mean, there's a direct, as far as I'm concerned, there's a direct correlation. But let's go on to the development. After you and I did that Solari report on the many faces of secrecy, we had the FASB 56 process start. After Dr. Skidmore's report, the Department of Defense announced they were going to do a big audit, and so they proceeded to spend almost $1 billion on a major audit. Before they announced that they couldn't complete the audit, they implemented something called FASB 56. Interestingly enough, it was approved by OMB and GAO and promulgated during the Kavanaugh hearing process.
They always love those distractions, don't they?
Right, they do. And interestingly enough, the first finding under FASB 56 occurred before the audit was finished. Now, grossly oversimplified, what FASB 56 does, and we've published a piece just on it. For anybody listening to this who wants to know more, we'll put a link in the subscriber links. What FASB 56 does is it allows all the covered agencies, all 20, I think it's 24 now, plus more than 150 related entities, and it may include contractors as well. It's a little bit obtuse. What it allows them to do is create secret books. A secret group of people can identify certain projects and flows, move them into secret books, and not disclose that they're doing it. So, unfortunately, what it means is that the financial statements you get are entirely meaningless. You have no idea what they mean.
Right.
And you have no idea who controls what they mean and what goes in and out. It's meaningless. And if you combine it with pre-existing national security waivers for private contractors and banks, unfortunately, what it means is not only now are U.S. Treasuries, the financial statements that tell you about the credit of U.S. Treasury statements irrelevant, meaningless, a lot of related, you know, private corporate bonds and stocks are also impossible to analyze. You don't have sufficient financial information to analyze them. You can't know what their financial statements mean. And as a result, we just published a new piece called Caveat Emptor that I wrote with my attorney, why investors need to do due diligence on U.S. Treasury and related securities. And basically what I say is, you know, if you have the secret decoder ring, then maybe you understand what the U.S. federal credit means. But as far as I can see, for all I know, they're moving all the assets out the back door. You know, if you buy a treasury and the money goes to buy a piece of equipment, for all I know, it's going to end up on a corporate balance sheet, basically as an open bailout gift through the back door. We don't know that it's not. There's no way to know. And so, if anything, we're significantly ratcheting up the secrecy in a way. My fear is we're going to get the worst of both worlds, you know, the worst of corporate America combined with the worst of government.
Yes. And that's very, very incompetent, corrupt fascism.
Right.
You know, someday someone's going to do a history of the different levels of secrecy that were created beginning in the late 1940s. And the secrecy has ratcheted up in stages. And maybe we've reached peak secrecy with this, you know, FASB 56. It's simply everywhere. It's introduced in such a banal way with this. Through the OMB and the like, and such I hate to insult accountants, Catherine. I hate to, but such a boring way to just engineering. They're taking the financial coup d'état
It was really funny. One of the things I said was, you know, they tore up the Constitution via an obscure accounting policy,
and it is a constitutional offense. And I would think that it could be legally challenged as unconstitutional. And why, you know, every hedge fund manager in the world isn't trying to organize a class action to sue the government, because how can they invest their clients' money responsibly if they, you know, if there's such secrecy, such darkness as to the numbers of both private sector companies doing business with the government and the government agencies themselves. This would be unconstitutional action. This would be state action. You know, I just had a thought, which is that, you know, when you talk about the different levels of financial secrecy, you know, it used to be a couple of years ago, I was listening to people like Rob Kirby talk about the Exchange Stabilization Fund and how they've just sat on a dark pool of dollars, and that's why government, U.S. government could always get sell off its bonds and the like, because if there were no buyers, it never had a failed, you know, bond auction, because if there were no buyers, the exchange stabilization fund would just buy up the debt itself, just to create the illusion that, you know, dollars were still in demand, blah, blah, blah. And okay, so you have the exchange stabilization fund. Let's just posit that that's the case. So a dark pool of dollars. But this just takes it to a whole new level. Now we're getting to FASB 56 adds a whole new dimension to a dark pool of dollars. It's not just a dark pool of dollars. Now it's significantly more. And that was bad enough, not knowing how many dollars are out there, or, you know, how many governments have been given, you know, the dollar template to print how many trillions of dollars they want to by the Treasury or the Federal Reserve. I mean, I would hate to be responsible for anyone else's money in this environment.
Right. Well, last year I closed my individual investment advisory business. And one of the reasons was related to what was happening. It was before the final FASB 56 was promulgated, but, you know, the handwriting was on the wall. And how do you know, in a world where everything's dark, how do you know what's happening? So it made me extremely nervous about that. One of the things I wanted to bring up was in 2011, the Standard & Poor's, which at the time was owned by McGraw-Hill, downgraded the U.S. federal credit from AAA to AA+. 18 days later, their CEO had to resign. Basically, I'm sure the government, you know, that was the price, the punishment from the government. And early 2013, the Department of Justice and a group of the state attorney generals brought a $5 billion lawsuit against S&P for its role in the mortgage fraud, but they didn't bring it against the other two rating agencies who had not dropped the federal credit in rating. And McGraw-Hill finally had to settle, I think it was 2 years later, $1 billion, but huge amount of money. And it really devastated the company. And the message was, if you are an institution in this market, basically what that is doing as a business matter is requiring you to pretend, you know, that the emperor is wearing clothes.
And yeah, so it's using a lawsuit. It's using the law as a weapon. Do what we say, or we will sue you. And that's what they do. They take a weapon and they threaten people. In the case of countries that wanted to go off the petrodollar in the last 20 years, they've threatened them militarily. In the case of S&P, they threatened them legally. It's ruled by threat. It's extremely coercive.
So I think the reason the hedge fund wouldn't sue the federal government and challenge the constitutional, you know, is frankly they're worried for their safety and the safety of their investors. They don't have a safe mechanism to challenge.
Yeah, well, if that's true, then we've reached a very low state of affairs. I thought that the reason they hadn't challenged yet is because, you know, it's still very early days. And the insider capitalist club, you know, which has a lot of hedge fund managers, are still probably doing quite well in these corrupt markets, precisely because they are insiders. I mean, these markets are so dirty and fraudulent and corrupt that, you know, you have to be an insider with insider knowledge to do well. And I think many hedge fund people, you know, are such. So maybe I was thinking that for the moment they're just sitting pat and just waiting until things go south. And then, of course, they'll say, hey, you know, who knew these markets were dark and rigged and blah.
I think you're right. It takes a while for these things to percolate. And it's one of the reasons we published the caveat emptor, was to put investors on notice, hey, you need to do due diligence. There's been a material event. And you can't just assume that treasuries are safe. Something's changed. Yeah. So let's turn to the 116th. Before we turn to 116th Congress, one of the things I wanted to mention, there's been a great deal of disclosure about the efforts to sabotage the presidential campaign by a variety of players in the bureaucracy, including the Department of Justice and FBI and other agencies. So the intelligence agency, State Department, NSA, and the sort of functioning of those bureaucracies significantly outside the law, including trying to sabotage the presidency. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about what has happened. And my concern is if we have people in significant government positions who feel free to completely ignore a variety of laws and function really as sort of mobsters making stuff up and playing politics with it, when you combine that with significant secrecy of operations and finances, you know, you're talking about, I don't know, you know, you're moving out of the realm of fascism into the realm of organized crime. not to make light of it. Yeah.
When someone wants to keep something secret from you, you'll be inclined to agree if there's trust there, if you feel you can trust the person. Of course, and therefore, if a government is lawless and corrupt, you're not inclined to want to trust that government to keep things secret from you as a, you know, ostensibly self-governing public. So yes, secrecy becomes even more problematic when the government is lawless. And yes, there was, if people want to know what these three-letter agencies were up to at the very end of the Obama administration and then at the beginning of the Trump administration, if they want to know about the efforts to prevent Trump from winning the presidency and then to get him out of office once he had won the presidency, I would recommend listening to any number of interviews by a former federal prosecutor by the name of Joe DiGenova, who's well-versed in the pre-election campaign to basically infiltrate the Trump administration with operatives on the specious claim that he was colluding with the Russians. I'm not sure what they were trying to get, some sort of to either derail the campaign or then to use after the election if he, you know, were to win. And then afterwards, they continued with a lot of the shenanigans, because even though Hillary lost, a lot of the lieutenants who were involved in the pre-election naughtiness, you know, remained in their positions, such as Comey and McCabe and Strzok and Page and blah at FBI and then at DOJ as well. And then they really ran with this Russian collusion to try to get Trump, you know, impeached or the 25th Amendment or blah, 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 because, well, for two reasons. They didn't want him in office, and they certainly didn't want him finding out about what they had been up to before the election. So I think all of this is probably going to come out. I sure hope it does. But it just can't be worse. The lawlessness just can't be worse. It just can't reach a higher level, really.
If you watch the process of the information sort of dribbling out over the last year, one of the things that really struck me is the extent to which you're really watching Keystone Cops. And, you know, in my experience, it was so easy to get away with these things 10 or 20 years ago, you know, that you could play Keystone Cops and not get caught. Now, I think the body politic is a lot more knowledgeable about the lawlessness. And, you know, there have been some good players who helped bring all of this out. But, you know, it's hard to believe that it's that completely, you know, that they feel that free to engage in criminal practices in their positions.
Catherine, I mean, they've had the last 50 years, ever since JFK, they've become more and more emboldened because they've basically become more and more corrupt and achieve more and more of their sort of anti-human goals. And of course, they thought they were absolutely invulnerable, and they never thought that Hillary would lose. And now they're just scurrying like rats because they know they're caught. And I hope Trump goes for the jugular on this one. I really do.
One of the things I noted during the McCabe interview, and then later the reporting that came out, I said, I have to tell Amy about this. It noted that the FBI had repeatedly redacted in the discovery to the, or the, the responses to the Hill, that McCabe had spent $70,000 on his conference room table. And I thought, if that isn't a metaphor for what all this secrecy is going to be used for, there it is.
I hope when the dust settles, that someone calls me from Washington and they say, Amy, we need to rewrite the secrecy laws to prevent that kind of ridiculous redaction that you saw in the McCabe hearing. Would you come to Washington and help us?
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful?
I would go and I would, well, you know, in a sense, they don't need to be rewritten because redactions shouldn't be done to prevent embarrassment to government officials, and redaction shouldn't be done, certainly not, to conceal right. criminal activity. So you can't redact to prevent embarrassment or revelations of corruption and other criminal activity. You can't. And yet I think it's routinely done. It's
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's just an abuse of power.
I don't know if you've ever heard Bill Binney describe the games of people lining their own pockets with taxpayers' money at the NSA. It's, you know, when Binney talks about it, it's just frightening. I mean, it's out of control. Okay, so let's turn to the new Congress. The 116th Congress just began in January. And just when you say things can't get worse, they get worse. So,
on the 1% of light and good, Catherine, the 1% of light and good.
Well, you know, it's whatever it's doing, it's certainly stirring the pot. It's also certainly making sure that Trump gets reelected if he runs. But we have a whole new group of incoming congressmen. Not one of them that I have heard has spoken up to say, we have too much secrecy about our finances. We need to do something about it. There was one moment when Ocasio-Cortez bought up the $21 trillion, and it was very deftly played to get rid of it and turn it into a joke, which was quite unfortunate. But there is, among the new congressmen, we have a bunch that promotes themselves as revolutionary, but in fact, there's been absolutely not one shred of suggestion that secrecy is a problem. Have you heard Bo Peep about secrecy from any of them?
No, but, you know, that said, I try not to give these people my attention very much because I have a sense that not all is what it seems with regard to these youthful, exuberant newcomers. These people are, the amount of coverage they're getting, the amount of deference they're getting from the Democratic leadership, I smell an intelligence operation behind Ocasio, or as Lionel calls her, Ocrazio, Senorita Ocasio-Cortez. I smell an intelligence operation behind her. I can't figure out whether she's a white hat intel person or a black hat intel person, or, you know, and black hat would be Mossad. I smell Mossad behind the Muslim representative from Minnesota, this Representative Omar, I believe her name is, who's often mm-hmm. coming out with allegedly anti-Semitic comments. I think she's Mossad all the way because the Israeli Secret Services love to get, you know, the anti-Semitism up and running and bombing right. their synagogues so that they can then, you know, come in and rally the troops on behalf of Israel and whatever.
Do you think she knows?
Probably. I think the intelligence services, both foreign and domestic, have completely penetrated the Congress. I think there are lots of ops going on with regard to various members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate. But definitely these newcomers strike me as ops of some sort. Now, Ocasio-Cortez, so she comes out with her Green New Deal and her socialism. Now, of course, this is redounding to Trump's advantage, the Republicans' advantage, I think. So is she run by the White Hats, the sort of pro-Trump military intelligence people? That one surprised me. Is she kind of a Soros Mossad creature? That one surprised me either. So I haven't quite figured it out. But, I mean, if you look at the incredibly disproportionate level of attention she and her other freshmen are getting, okay, this doesn't happen in a normal world. In a normal world, newbies go to Congress and they do what they're told and they shut up. These people are not doing that, and they're not being asked to shut up, although Pelosi, you know, grimaces. And
well, but if you look at you know, when the new Green Deal was first slapped out, there was a big protest gathering in Pelosi's office. Well, if you look at congressional security, none of those people could get in there unless they let them in. You know, it was staged. It was clearly staged.
Almost everything you're seeing on the political, well, on the political stage, we'll just use that right now, is staged. It's all right. An act. I just can't, I'm not quite certain who's hiring the actors, if you will, some of the actors. And so Ocasio, yeah, she's getting a lot of press, but this is not a coincidence. This is an op. It's taking a lot of attention. Everyone's concentrating on her latest utterances and that of Omar from Minnesota and right. Not paying attention to other things that they should be. I'm sure something, you know, kind of akin in level of importance to, you know, Fast 56 is probably in the works. Who knows? But, you know, we're all paying attention to the latest utterances. And that's why I kind of just, as a matter of principle, say, unless it's shoved in my face, I'm not going to listen to these people because I know I'm being played. I'm being played.
Right. When I published the annual wrap-up on pension funds at the end of 2017, I had a picture of a cow and a farmer milking milk into a milk bucket. And the milk bucket had a hole in its bottom, and it was, you know, all the milk was running out into the deep state. And the title was, "Does Your Pension Fund Have a Deep State Problem?" And I kept saying to everybody, why should we put more milk in the bucket if there's a hole in the bottom? We need to deal with the hole. And the hole is about secret finances and the black budget and money running out of the milk bucket. Now, what we have with all this sort of incoherent proposals for revolutionary government policies from Ocasio-Cortez and this whole bunch all come down to more taxes and more government, more resources flowing into the milk bucket with no discussion of the hole in the bottom.
Yes.
And it looks to me very simply like this is the early part of the marketing campaign to radically increase public support to pour more milk into the bucket with no discussion of the fact that the hole is still sucking money through. And so this is the next harvest.
Yeah, for me, the most surreal moment of the State of the Union address was when the president said, I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, socialism, we reject socialism in the United States, and kind of looking at Bernie Sanders and with a side glance at Ocasio-Cortez. And a number of Republicans in the chamber rose to their feet chanting USA, USA. And I thought, this is absolutely ridiculous, because these Republican members are chanting USA as if what we have in the United States is an anti-socialist model. as if we have free markets in this country. As if they're jumping to their feet saying, we oppose socialism, we're in favor of free market capitalism. No, they're in favor of corrupt crony capitalist insider trading riddled markets. And that's what they're opposing to socialism. It was just surreal. So, you know, obviously I can't be on the socialist bandwagon, not only because of the milk bucket problem, but just because, I mean, even if you had a relatively non-corrupt government, there are problems with the socialist model. But I look at the other side opposing the socialism and think, well, you guys are almost just as bad with your corrupt crony capitalism.
Well, one is basically saying we're going to steal massive amounts of money and let corporations run everything, and, you know, with dark money. And the other saying we're going to tax more and spend it. Well, they propose to spend it on individuals. I don't think it's ever going to get there. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe right. A little bit more would get to individuals under the socialist model than under the crony capitalist model. But that's speculation at this point. I think what we as citizens need to do is realize that, you know, when you see the Republicans chanting USA against the socialist slogans, realize you're being misled there too. And we need to get back to just find our grounding with first principles, which is right. The market capitalist system is probably the way to go, but they need to be truly unrigged markets, truly free and transparent, with careful and non-corrupt regulation. So often now, the regulators just run cover for the corruption. They're in there saying, right, oh, we're regulating. But in fact, they're just providing cover. It can be precious
metals. Well, here's
metals,
the thing.
And the manipulation, the suppression of precious metals, or it can be virtually anything.
Right.
But we are so far away from free, transparent markets that for anyone to jump to their feet chanting USA in response to Ocasio is equally ridiculous.
Right. So I would say without financial transparency, both in the markets, but also in the political jurisdictions. So America's 3,100 counties, if I can't see the sources and uses of government money and performance in my place, it's like a symphony playing in the dark. Now, one of the things the sort of new freshman Congress are doing is playing on the legitimate anger of the millennials. Jeffrey Gundlach is my vote for one of the best bond managers in the country. And he gave an interview to Yahoo Finance the other day and basically said, if you look at how much the boomers are taking out versus how much the millennials are taking out of the federal budget, it's pretty unfair. And right. Certainly if you look at the student debt situation, I just think the unfairness towards the millennials is off the charts. And so they have very good reason to be angry. And right. And what's very clever is the people who've harvested the millennials to me are the deep state. And the deep state is now playing them in a way that they're going to get the millennials to do their marketing for the next round of harvesting, which will, you guessed it, harvest the millennials, not only because it'll harvest the millennials, but it'll harvest the money they would have inherited from their parents otherwise.
I think the millennials are, God bless them. I think they're easy pickings for the manipulative tactics of the deep state. They're just absolutely easy pickings. They, unfortunately, don't have a lot of historical knowledge. They have no idea what this country once was. And so although they'll complain if they're pinched, I think they just lack the knowledge probably needed to discern false solutions from true solutions. I think we disabled them from really developing wisdom because of the educational system that we've put them through. And so I think if they are to be rescued, it's going to be by the older generation, like people like you and me, maybe.
Well, but one of the things I'm grappling with is how can I make the information simple and easy and accessible to them? So I was going back and forth with a colleague today who had emailed me about homelessness, and I was trying to persuade him that homelessness was a symptom and you can't solve the symptom by throwing money at it. You need to bring transparency to the root causes so that you don't have to fund homelessness. There won't be homelessness if you deal with the root causes. So the question is for the millennials, how do you help them understand and see the root causes and do it in a way which is, not overwhelming?
I wish I had an answer for you. I wish I did. Their existence is really ahistorical in the sense that they don't have a sense of history. I don't know what tools they have I think they're going to need some guidance from the older generation. I mean, when you think, revolution is usually, the job of the young folk, but it's so deeply ironic that the counter-revolution, if you will, that's being staged now in some areas of the world against globalization and against neoliberal economics and against, the welfare warfare model, it's being staged by the older folks, the people who can remember a time when we had much greater freedom, economic and otherwise. For example, the people who voted for Brexit in the United Kingdom. These were the old fogies down in Wales and Cornwall and blah, blah, blah. Not the millennials in places like London and Manchester and all the new ones who just want to be able to travel freely in Europe and go wherever they want to go. It was the old people who knew how much has been lost and tried to take the country back and gain a little freedom. And I think, if you look at, our own country, the biggest adherents, for example, followers of Ron Paul back in the day and and now followers of many followers in the MAGA movement, they tend to be older. There's some young ones, but the demographic is decidedly older because they remember. So this whole issue of historical memory is very important. And, you know, it's going to be, I think, in this counter-revolution, the older generation, hopefully coming to the rescue of the young ones who are going to have to be re-educated, not in FEMA camps, of course, but just told,
right.
Told about an earlier time.
Well, one of the things that I hear from people is anybody who's responsible for assets, whether they're running a business or running a portfolio or, you know, are responsible for managing family savings, they're listening to the discussion on both sides of the aisle in Washington, you know, whether it's the Republicans or it's the Democrats, you know, whether it's tax and spend or crazy corporate, you know, fascism. And they're saying, you know, what they're hearing is they're hearing lawlessness. And what they're saying is, you know, how can I manage assets in a world? And then, of course, you watch what the FBI and Department of Justice was up to. You know, one of my favorite quotes of the incoming administration was Chuck Schumer saying in a TV interview, God bless him, well, the president has to do what the CIA tells him. It basically saying the intelligence agencies run the country, not the president, and he's going to learn.
So there are six ways to Sunday to get you.
Right. And they do. Yeah, they do. So Chuck Schumer explained the governance model that's been in place since, you know, the Kennedy assassination. Anyway, I think it's helping people understand that without law, you know, it's hard to have an economy and it's hard to have a life. And that's what we're grappling with. How do the people who believe in the rule of law move forward? And I come back to your article on secrecy, because I think the first thing you need to get back to any state of lawfulness is to reduce the secrecy.
Yes. But you yourself said when we were talking about the hedge funds that even the tool of law may be limited by fear of reprisal and a retribution, such as that which was visited on S&P for downgrading the U.S. So I think we've reached a point where even, you know, the tool of law might be limited. And I think that
right.
If it is, there's probably only the tool of the pocketbook. And I know you've spoken about this. And this means getting out of this. Don't feed the beast, you know.
Right.
Don't bank with J.P. Morgan. Don't
right.
bank with Citibank. Go local. Do not feed the beast. Don't buy
right.
corporate products of corporations that are dark. Don't. It's the only weapon really we have in the short term. Yes, in the long
right.
term, we can hopefully lock up people who abuse power in government and use law as a weapon against people who are trying to
right.
bring about more freedom and transparency. But in the short term, I think it just might be our only weapon would be using our money to the extent we have any to fight with that.
Right. And we have not only money, we have attention. A withdrawal from media, which lies, is very, very powerful. The more we deny them eyeballs, that's also very powerful. I think it's a very powerful weapon. It's one that's been used very successfully throughout history, and we haven't tried it yet.
And, we're constantly convinced we have no power. We have all the power in the world.
Right, I agree.
The propaganda is that we have none. And every single message you get over the airwaves during the course of the day is meant to ratchet up your sense of insecurity and inferiority. Are you, are you worried enough about the latest this or that? Oh, no, maybe I need to be worried more. The more anxious we get, the less in control we feel. And that's exactly what they want. They don't want us to have a sense of our own control over the situation. We have all of the control. And that's
right.
It's just mind control. That's how the very few control the many, to persuade the many.
Well, I've been on the other side, and I know how afraid they are of the crowd. So, you know, I know what you're saying is true. I have to tell you, one of my favorite quotes from John Rappaport is he says, hopelessness is an op, and it's planet-wide.
Oh, that says it all. It is an op.
Yeah. It is an up.
And it's a very, very deep up, running down into the most deep levels concerning the nature of human consciousness. I mean, one way to look at organized religion is a way to give humans an avenue for expressing their sense of awe at the universe and their spirituality without letting them know that they actually have a great, much more power in their mind than they realize. I mean, organized religion is an op, and I believe in source, but organized religion is an op designed to instill powerlessness. If the only way you feel you can succeed is waiting for God to save you, well, that is an insidious way of emasculating you and your own sense of power and control.
Well, that's why you see, you know, in America, we've seen the growth is all in the non-denominational churches, and that's not what they preach at all. It's kind of spilling out of the control. One of the things I wanted to mention to you, my favorite internet video is something called The Battle of Kruger. Have you ever seen it?
No.
I just sat down with Robert Duper here in the Netherlands and got him to watch it. It's the story of a fight between a group of water buffaloes and both lions and crocodiles in the Kruger National Park. And it's all about how the water buffaloes get together and get up enough courage to attack back and save their little ones from the lions. And it's kind of a metaphor for, I think, you know, what can happen when we decide to start exercising our power of choice to not support these guys, to withdraw, to not finance. Next week on the Salieri Report, we're going to be doing Why Are We Financing This with Dr. Catherine Horton and talking about this same exact issue. So let me just turn.
She's a physicist who was targeted, right? I've heard her in interviews before. She's just lovely, person.
Yeah, and very, very interested in finance and very sophisticated about finance. So now I want to turn to you and some of your latest work and how we follow your work. You've had several publications since the Many Faces of Secrecy. So tell us a little bit about Amy Benjamin's new pieces.
My oeuvre, such as it is. Well, I did Secrecy, and then I turned to intervention in Syria did an article on that. So the intervention, it had two stages beginning in about 2011. It was sort of a humanitarian-ish intervention designed to get Assad out of power. And then when that didn't really seem to be getting enough international support, in other words, when the Libya model seemed to be failing for Syria, they switched over to the ISIS counterterrorism model. And they basically rewrote the script very fast. They created ISIS, Langley ran it, and kept us in Syria up until recently. Trump's trying to get us out. We'll see if he can do it. But that was what the article is about, sort of unmasking that ridiculous historical moment where we tried to get in to intervene in order to control the country, probably for standard imperialist reasons relating to oil pipelines and blah, blah, or Israel wanting more.
Do you know if the rumors are true that that ISIS seized up a lot of gold and we've now gotten the gold from them? Do you know if that's true?
I don't know if it's true. I did see the Zero Hedge article, and I'm not quite sure how to read that. I mean, my question is, if they have the gold, where'd they get it from? And if it's from Syria, why do we have the gold? Why aren't we delivering it back to the government in Damascus? Where does the gold come from? Is it just they collected it from, the people in the territories they occupied? Why isn't it being returned to those people? Why do we walk off?
I'm assuming that's why we created ISIS, was to go in and dig out the natural resources.
It's so corrupt, Catherine. It's so corrupt. Anyway, that was what my last published article is about, and I'm currently knee deep in a very long article writing it. Hope to be done by August. And this is on It's very doctrinal. It's about how globalist legal scholars have manipulated the sources of international law, treaties, and customary law in order to further globalization, you know, the diffusion of authority away from the nation state upward into international institutions and actors. And the title of it's going to be Globalists and the Corruption of Sources. And it's very hard-hitting. It's very doctrinal. It might not be quite as accessible to the ordinary, to a lay person, but it's very hard-hitting. And I'm trying to, for want of a better word, take down a couple of high-rolling legal scholars in the United States who I think have really sold their souls. I won't name names, but I do in the article. And I'm knee deep in that right now. It's going to be every bit as long as the secrecy article, and we'll see if I can if anyone will publish it.
Okay. Well, will you let us know as soon as it's available?
I will. I'm going to be sending it out to journals in August. That's the next publication window. And if it gets picked up, I'll know in, you know, probably by September, and I'll let you know. And then if it's picked up, it'll probably come out in, you know, January of next year. But it hopefully will do. I'm hoping it will do a little damage. I hope they'll feel a pinprick of remorse upon reading it. But I'm not holding my breath.
Well, but here's the thing. What I will say in all of your pieces is they do an extraordinary job of helping someone who's interested understanding how is this all engineered. And it's hard to put these things together. And you're really a master at digging out the information, integrating it, and putting it, you know, laying it out in a coherent form, so that we can really get a lot more intelligent about what you're writing about. So this is unbelievably helpful to people who really do want to understand what's going on.
Well, thank you very much for the compliment. Although I do think that just to push back a little on what you're saying, I think the ordinary person has everything they need to figure it out. And they definitely shouldn't put too much stock in academics. In a sense, I'm kind of trying to write to wake up the academic class. I think the ordinary folks class can more or less sort it out on their own. They're that smart. The academics are the idiots, though. So I'm kind of doing my bit to wake them up. But ordinary people, they just need to take a deep breath and to listen and really think about how they could do some good old fashioned harm to a very corrupt system and hopefully bring it down. And they'll see, you know, they can use their money and withdraw their attention, and they can do that. But thank you for the compliment.
Okay.
The well, Amy Benjamin does not need Amy Benjamin, fellow academics might.
It's funny, I just have to tell you one story. I was just writing about it for a history I'm doing for The Real Game of Missing Money, which is our sort of, you know, collection of all the material on the missing money. And I used to do a radio show on KPFA radio in San Francisco, and it was called Community Business. And every week or so, I would get on there, and as the former Assistant Secretary of Housing, I would talk about all the corruption, what was going on in the mortgage markets that was wrong. Well, suddenly, in the summer of 2008, I was thrown off in July in a very, you know, it was kind of an op situation. It was very bogus, made up.
Yeah.
Suddenly, I'm thrown off. And then the Bohemian Grove happens right after that. And then Fannie and Freddie are nationalized. And, of course, I'm not on KPFA radio to comment on any of it. I've been thrown off. And shortly after they were nationalized, one of the top, very prestigious, well-admired money manager in San Francisco publishes a letter on their website. Apparently, they had invested $1 billion in Fannie Mae in April and lost it all in August. Uh-oh. So in 4 months, they'd managed to lose 100% on their Fannie Mae position. And the letter was beautifully crafted and said, you know, we did very thorough due diligence. We had no idea. And I read it and I said, every trucker in America knew the mortgage market was toast. How could they not know?
Yeah.
The Assistant Secretary of Housing was on drive-by radio at 5 o'clock, you know, a couple times a month for the last 5 years saying the mortgage market. How could they not know?
Oh, my God.
And you thought,
that's a beautiful story.
There are parallel universes. There really are parallel universes. It's amazing. So every trucker in America knew that I ever talked to or dealt with. Everyone knew. It was quite remarkable.
I could just, in this regard, just shake the president, who I'm generally quite fond of, when he gets out and he's touting these specious, bogus, Sieg Paul Craig Roberts and John Williams economic numbers and blah, blah, blah. When if you look at so many indicators that real people know about, like, you know, he just signed an executive order about veterans committing suicide and trying to help them. And, you know, millennials, of course, can't afford to buy a house, and student loan debt and the drug crisis and the opiate crisis and the homelessness. I mean, all the indicators of the well-being of the country that they have less, that they have greater difficulty fudging are terrible. They're just terrible. So,
right.
You know, they come out with these bogus inflation numbers and job creation numbers. But the country and people know it. And, you know, they're willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, but they need some truth on this. The country is in a terrible, terrible state. Is it perhaps a little better than it would have been had Hillary won? Yeah. But it's in a terrible state. And sooner or later, he's going to have to be honest, because I'll tell you, there's nothing more soul-destroying than constantly being lied to. And it's going to be on the side of the people. He has got to start telling the truth. He's lied his way all the way through the first 2.5 years of office. I think for good
right.
reason, you know, for good ends. He's using a deception and lies as a weapon against the deep state, I think, for the most part. But don't ask me about Venezuela. but he's got to, if he wants to stem the suicide rate, not just amongst veterans, but amongst other classes, if he wants to stem the opioid crisis, he has got to start telling the truth. The lies are eating people up at this point, because they know on the ground how awful it is. And
right.
trotting out these bogus numbers is just killing the country. It's killing us. Literally killing us. So, Mr. President, please, truth finally now.
You know, what I would do if it was up to me is I would make sure that we had fantastic county finances for everyone, and let the reengineering begin, but let it begin bottom up in a way that significantly improves returns and performance and creates a massive amount of jobs. The problem is those jobs more often than not are going to be small business, not corporation. The small businesses are going to gain in market share vis-a-vis the corporations. The corporations aren't necessarily going to like it. So, but I'm with you. That's why I think secrecy, you know, in terms of financial secrecy is destroying the economy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then just lies, just the manipulation in the markets it's just distorted asset and commodity prices, the price of everything. There's no price discovery from the people I've listened to can tell. There's none. We don't know what really
right.
the value of anything. The markets are so manipulated. I mean, gold and
right.
silver, don't get me started. I mean, come on. I mean, that's why, you know, the chant of USA, USA. We have a totally managed economy. It's probably more managed than the Soviet economy was.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And it's we are the most managed economy. Oh, God, don't get it. So please sit down in your seat and don't jump up chanting USA. And I'm a real patriot, but please don't do that. That's ridiculous.
Okay, Amy Benjamin, you're great. You keep us posted on everything you're doing, and you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much for reaching out, Catherine. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye.